G'day, I am Mordechai Becher.
And I am Yehoshua Kirsch.
And welcome to Two Rabbis and a Podcast. And welcome to any new viewers here. And thank you for all the viewers who are watching, the multitudes. And please like, share, and do whatever you're supposed to do. So
whatever the kids do.
Yeah. So we can get more people watching this because we think it's valuable. I don't know. Okay. So today's topic is something called Da'as Torah. I have to say it with a strong Ashkenazic accent. Da'as Torah. That is the only way to pronounce it. Da'as Torah, loosely, to define what we mean by that, is this type of mystical power or even legal power that certain people defined as the great leaders of the Jewish people in Torah have the ability to say something and a person must, this is generally how it's looked at, that the person must listen. And it's not, I think we have to distinguish it from what we call psak halacha. Psak halacha means halachic decision-making. Someone says, the milk spilled on the schnitzel in the fridge. It was sitting there for 12 hours, 24 hours. What do I do? So the rabbi, there are set criteria by which you can figure these things out. There might be some wiggle room in terms of extenuating circumstances and so on. But basically, it's cut and dry legal issues.
Although I once asked Rav Scheinberg, a blessed memory, a question, and he asked me, is this a theoretical question or is it a practical question? Because if it's a practical question, I get siyata deshmaya.
Right.
So he felt like he gets some kind of extra help. Even I was presenting a halachic question to him, but he expressed that he gets some kind of siyata deshmaya, kind of heavenly aid to come to the right halachic decision.
Sure. On the other hand, it is a halachic area, which means I'm asking the rabbi for his halachic expertise. I do hope that God helps him, and he may, right? But with or without that, these are halachic areas where you can offer evidence. You can offer clear-cut, you know, lines of reasoning. So, in fact, the way the term Da'as Torah is actually used in the Gemara, in the Talmud, is quite different from the way it's used in what I just said. All right, so the Talmud in Gemara in Chulin 90b discusses the sciatic nerve, gida nasheh, prohibited by Torah law in an animal's thigh. And it says, you know, if it would only be one of the thighs, it would it be right or left? So the Gemara says, right thigh. And the Gemara asks, do you say that because of Da'as Torah or because of Da'as Noiteh? Now, Da'as Torah is understood by Rashi as meaning you have evidence from the verses, you have evidence from the Talmud that this is the case. Da'as Noiteh means my mind feels that it is this way. It leans towards that. That's more of an intuition. So the way we use Da'as Torah today is more along the intuition line than the way Talmud uses Da'as Torah. As Da'as Torah in the Talmud is used as something which I can is fairly clear cut, and I can bring evidence for it, scriptural or other evidence. Whereas Da'as Noiteh means I feel this is it, which may be legitimate. I'm just saying the terminology is not exact.
Right. So thing. Just to zero in on your definition, it's as if this person has in some way embodied Torah to such an extent that even their opinions on things that are not necessarily Torah would reflect Torah. Because they, in other words, they have become so much imbued with Torah that at some point even their opinions, it could be opinions about policy, it could be opinions about politics, In other words, their opinions at some point become almost as if you heard it from Torah itself.
Well, it's type of interesting. That is, some would say that is why we study Torah. We study Torah, not, we don't just study what to do and what not to do. That would just be a list of instructions, right? We study the ins and outs of Torah, the reasoning, the rationale, something which is even wrong and why it's wrong, called a hava mina. Why do we do that? One of the reasons is so that we can start to think like the Torah. So a person who has studied enough Torah in sufficient depth with intellectual honesty, so it may very well be that when they look at the world, they look at the world very much through the eyes of Torah. I think that's the meaning when we pray every day and we ask Hashem v'ha'er. It's that we have the blessing before Shema. So we say Lushma, Lulmod, Lhavin, Lahaskil, we want to understand and be enlightened and to understand and to teach and to learn and to teach and to guard and to do. And then we add v'ha'er einenu b'sarasecha, enlighten our eyes in your Torah. Does that mean to understand the Torah? If it does, that was already covered. I think that might mean give us an ability to look at the world through the eyes of Torah. We ask for that. And there is something to that. Now, that doesn't automatically mean that the person is going to be right, I think. I mean, we certainly know there's an entire tractate of the Talmud, Horaeus or Horaeus. I really still do not know how to pronounce it. I've heard both. But it talks about mistaken rulings of the Sanhedrin. That's the great, great Torah sages, right? Who could have made a mistake? It's difficult to know. I remember talking to, we had a Shabbos table discussion, actually not discussion, argument. But anyway, we were talking about this once, and I mentioned that I had read that in Vilnius, where the Mir Yeshiva was stuck in Lithuania during the Second World War. Nazis were coming, were Soviet Union controlled, that the Nazis were on their way. So there was this, everyone has probably heard of this idea that they were able to get visas to go to Asia via Japan. And it was a question whether you should do this or not. Not everyone was, it was not clear. People didn't know what would happen. So you get your visa, you pay money, right? You get into a train in Russia. Not like the Soviet Union was paradise, right? So people were asking the opinions of rabbis of what to do. And there were rabbis who were against it. They said, it's not a good idea. Better to stay here. Now that was, I mean, who am I to judge? They're sitting in that situation. But there were, apparently the story goes, there were two Hasidic students in Mir. And there was no Rebbe, there was no Hasidic Rebbe available to ask. So they had no choice. They had to ask a misnaget, a litvak. They had to ask one of the rabbonim about what they should do. Should they try to get the visas and go through Russia to who knows where, to Japan, etc., or not? So they went to a Litvisher rabbi that was completely non-Hasidic, and they asked him, and he said, you should not go. So they decided, right, let's do the opposite of what this rabbi said, because he's not Hasid. So they went and their lives were saved. So I mentioned this. My wife said, you don't think that rabbi knew that that's what they're going to do? That's why he said that.
That's a litvak. Oh, that's a litvak.
He knew they'd do the opposite. So told them, don't go, knowing that they'd go. So he saved their lives. So, okay. But it doesn't automatically mean, and so.
Also, just as long as you mention these kind of things, when you ask a halachic decision, let's say I went to a Rav, he's the Rav I always go to, he's considered an expert. I ask a halachic decision, and then I act based on his decision. Am I given some kind of immunity if I make the wrong choice? Or is it seen that I am an autonomous being who's held responsible for my choices and actions. And the best that can happen is I'm seeking advice, but I'm ultimately the one responsible. I'm the one who's going to either receive reward or punishment based on this. Do I get shielded? Because it seems like in some of the discussion about the Beis Din HaGadol, like the Sanhedrin, where there, like, I'm supposed to follow it, even though I think it's wrong. Even though, like, let's say Rabbi Yoshua, and he had, you know, really strong reasons to believe that the decision of the Sanhedrin is wrong, but he has to follow it.
So it's interesting that. So I don't know if we, I think we might be able to distinguish the case you're talking about is the Sanhedrin determined the dates of the calendar. And that determined that now there's an explicit derivation from the verse that the Sanhedrin has to be followed even if they're wrong, even if they made a mistake. Atem, afilu mutim, even if you are mistaken. In fact, what if the Sanhedrin is, so there it's a little different. What about another case? So the Gemara in Horius, this is going to drive me absolutely out. I need to consult a major grammarian. That's what a linguist. Okay. Anyway, so the Gemara there says the following. So we have two cases. You've got what's called Zaken Mamre, a rebellious elder. The Sanhedrin comes to a vote. Here's a guy who is equivalent level, because if he's just a nobody, then he's not really a rebellious elder. He's just an idiot, right? So he's a smart guy. He's a Torah scholar. He could have been on the Sanhedrin, but he's not. And he thinks they're wrong. And he rules against them. So we say that's a capital offense. He's a rebellious elder, Zaken Mamre. On the other hand, the Gemara, it's on the first page of Horius, the Gemara says that what if you have a great Torah scholar who's convinced the Sanhedrin is wrong and he follows their ruling, knowing that they're wrong, and then they retract the decision, does he bring a sin offering for someone who's done a sin because of a mistake or inadvertent sin? The Gemara says he does bring a sin offering. And the Gemara asks, why? It says, because ta'ah b'mitzvah lishmoa dibrei chachamim. He made a mistake in the mitzvah of listening to the sages. He thought, this is based on Rashi and others, He thought that you have to follow them even if they're wrong. In fact, you're not supposed to follow them if they made a mistake. So he brings a sin offering. Because he did not follow his own conscience, he followed the Sanhedrin. So here, Nachmanides asks, is this not a contradiction? If he rules against the Sanhedrin, he's a rebellious elder. If he doesn't follow his conscience and follows the Sanhedrin, even though he's convinced they're wrong, he brings a sin offering. That means there was some type of, no, there was a lack of indemnity here, right? Yeah. So he's caught between Scylla and Charybdis, right? He's the rock in the hard place. What's he supposed to do?
Yeah.
So the Ramban and the Rambam just alludes to this, but they both say the same thing. It is after he has discussed it with the Sanhedrin, and then he continues in his own stance, he's a rebellious elder, until he's discussed it with them, he is obligated to follow his conscience. In other words, the key is, has he presented his view to the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court? Meaning, according to both Rambam and the Ramban, until the moment that he's actually presented it and they've heard his view and argued it with it and refuted it, he's obligated to follow his conscience. And he's not a rebellious elder if he does that. But once he's presented his view and they've heard it and outvoted him, he has to have the humility to the authority of the Sanhedrin to say, okay, I'm following them. And if he doesn't, he's a rebellious elder. So the key is...
when he follows them and it's found out that it was a mistake, after he has presented his idea, he would not bring a korban chatos. He would not bring a sin offering.
Correct. Right. I don't So, and it's interesting that this idea is, it's almost like one of the central ideas of democracy. You know? It's only really a meaningful vote if you've heard the dissenting voice. It's only a democracy if there's a, if there's an opposition party that can speak, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so, you know, in this case, the Chazanish understands this as saying that since they haven't heard the voice, the dissenting voice of this minority, this individual, so it detracts somewhat from the authority of their vote. Once they've heard it, their authority has, that's the authority of the Torah. So, you know, based on that, Chazanish says something, we were discussing this before, the Chazanish says something fascinating. He says, let's say your rabbi, who you follow for most of your halachic questions, he rules leniently, or could be stringently, but let's say he rules leniently on a Torah issue, which the majority of authorities in the world disagree with him. He says, you're entitled to follow your own rabbi. Why? Since there was no meeting of all these rabbis in which they discussed it and heard your rabbi's dissenting opinion, so it's not considered an authentic, authoritative majority. Because it's a majority without a minority. They didn't hear his claim. If they would have a meeting, get together, right? And he'd raise his opinion, and then they'd all say, nah, et cetera. Different story. But until that time, you don't, you know, so that's type of interesting.
So that, yes. Yeah, so certainly this would apply to the Sanhedrin. But what if you had something like the Council of the Four Lands, where you have, I mean, I don't really know the entire workings of the Council of the Four Lands, but it seemed like you had policy decisions and halachic decisions that are being made by a large group of rabbonim. So could somebody argue that in a case like that, after the opinion has been expressed, he should be mevatel his das, that he should humbly give up his opinion and follow it? Like, if there's been a large group of rabbonim, it's not a Sanhedrin, or let's say it was published in a journal, widely read, widely reviewed by Talmidei Chachamim, and there was a consensus against it.
I think that he still may have the right to follow his own view, or at least an obligation to present his dissenting view to them. But it probably would be a wise thing. In other words, we do like, to some degree, to have a consensus, especially if there are great authorities involved. But I don't know. It's really hard to know. Very, very difficult to know. But today, Agudas Yisrael, who it is historians believe invented the modern day term Das Torah, right, as being represented by their Moetzes Gedolei Torah, their assembly of Torah sages, which they consider to be authoritative and binding. It's hard to see that because much of the Jewish world is not,
it's not represented.
Doesn't represent them. I mean, you know, right. there are many, many communities that don't accept the authority of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. There are some to the, what you might say, to the right of them, maybe some, the Satmar, I doubt if Satmar accepts them. I don't think Lubavitch accepts the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. They have their own, I don't know who they have, but
Sfardim,
right?
Sfardic Jews.
Yeah. The Sfardic Jews accept that? Not all. Right. I mean, they've got the Sfardic. So it's very, you know, we are to some degree balkanized, in that sense, and it's hard to see anyone, even when, you know, you have newspapers like Hamodia, Yated, etc., declaring someone to be the Poisek Hador, generational leader in halachic, it's really not correct.
Right.
There are others who, there are whole communities who, there are communities who never heard of him.
Right.
I remember, you know.
There's a story, Chanoch Teller, I think I heard Chanoch Teller, somebody said he wrote this somebody read it in something he wrote, but it was about photo grain lenses, photochromatic lenses that change into sunglasses when you're in the sun and then change back when you're not. So there was a woman who was, her last name was Orbach. She was the daughter of a Blyoshev, and she was, and her father-in-law was a Shlomo Zalman. And her optometrist or ophthalmologist suggested she would benefit from photo gray lenses, but he said to her, you need to ask a posek.
Oh.
You know, which, whether you're allowed to use them on Shabbos.
Dispute about it.
Right. And it ends up that Reb Shlomo Zalman said you can use them, and Reb Liyoshev said you can't.
Right.
So she told him, you know, my father holds that I can use them, but my father-in-law, I'm sorry, my father-in-law holds I can use them, but my father says I can't use them. And he said something like, I told you to ask a Rav, not your parents, or something like that.
Yeah, it's a classic.
Yeah.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
But we do have arguments, and there's arguments in policy, and it's very difficult to say that there's any one. That if we had a Sanhedrin, that would represent Das Torah 100%, and everyone in the Jewish people, based on Deuteronomy 17, has to obey the Sanhedrin. Although even there, as I said, the rabbi can follow his conscience up to the point where he's debated it with them, right? But that would be binding. Is there no body today which has that same, there's no individual or body today that has that same power of authority over the Jewish people. It's really voluntary which community you choose to be part of. If I want to be part of the Agudas Yisrael community, whatever that means, I don't even know what that means, right?
Yeah.
Then I guess I would voluntarily bind myself to the rulings of the Moetzes. On the other hand, if I am in the Yeshiva University community, which I actually am, I teach there, but am I in that community? I guess, then you'd be following the rulings of Rabbi Herschel Schechter and Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who don't always agree. But so,
is there a notion that you, in your relationship with a Rav, let's say you have chosen a Rav, that you should be mevatel your das, that you should humbly accept whatever they tell you? And if that's the case, are you shielded from consequences if the decision is the wrong decision? Now, I'm not talking about, let's say, the Holocaust question. I'm talking about, you know, like, let's say he said something's kosher and ends up being treif. So is there some kind of immunity that I get because I followed the system? I asked a Rav. I'm encouraged in my relationship with a Rav, you know, to think of him as, you know, in lofty terms. So am I encouraged to be mavato my das, or again, do I always have to remember that I'm an autonomous being? I'm ultimately held responsible for every one of my decisions. And what I'm getting from a Rav is advice, but I'm the one who ends up making the decision. I'm the one who ends up facing the results.
I think it depends to a great degree, first on how much you know. If it's an area in which I'm completely ignorant, and I go and ask a posek, then it makes sense. I'm going to be completely annul myself to his. I know nothing about this, right? What? So the Torah obligates me to go to an expert, right? Logic obligates me to go to an expert, right? I go to the expert. I have no clue. So I rely on him. I think in that case, I'd have an indemnity. But let's say it's an area which is not pure halacha, and I do have knowledge, or even if it is pure halacha, but I've studied the area myself, and I am bothered a little bit by what he says. I have some reservations. First and foremost, I am allowed to ask questions. I'm allowed to ask him.
There are times when they get annoyed if you do that. Yeah.
They can get annoyed, but I'm allowed to. You know, there's a beautiful, beautiful Reb Chaim Voloshiner of the Voloshin Yeshiva, as Litvish as you can get, right? So this is not a Hasidic thing, right? Litvish as you get. He writes in his commentary on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, the Mishnah says that it says, "Yei beischa, beis vad l'chachamim." Your house should be a gathering place for the wise. Heavy misabek, heavy shoisa, but sames derem, drink their words with thirst. Heavy misabek ba'afar aglehem. So that's usually translated as heavy misabek ba'afar aglehem, means cling to the dust of their feet. Reb Chaim Voloshin says no. Mitabek comes from the word avkut, wrestle with their words, with humility at the dust of their feet, but you have to wrestle with the words. And he says, Asur, I'm quoting now, Asur l'talmid l'kabel es divrei rabo in yesh lo kushyos aleihem. It is prohibited for the student to accept the words of his rabbi if he's got questions on them. He says, and sometimes the truth will be with the student. Any of my students listening, it's not in your case. We're talking about other rabbis and students. Okay. But in any case, that the truth is with the student. He says, the small, just like the small kindling can kindle a great bonfire, the student's question may enlighten and lead the rabbi to understand something a little differently. Right? And it's something which is so I don't think that, look, Igros Moshe, Reb Moshe Feinstein, who was acknowledged as one of the, if not the greatest halachic decisor or posek in the 20th century, in America, certainly. So in his introduction to his multi-volume responsa, Igros Moshe, his introduction is just enlightening. He says, why should you listen to me? Why should you accept what I said? He says, I'm not on a Sanhedrin. He says, in humility, he probably wouldn't be qualified to be on the Sanhedrin. He probably would, but okay, he says he's not qualified. He says, he says, the answer is that it's not my say-so that obligates you. He says, it's just you've asked me the question. I have shown you in a line of solid reasoning and logic and evidence going back to the Talmud that this is the ruling. And he says, and I've laid out my reasoning in my responsa. He says, so if you can refute it, go ahead. But if you cannot, what obligates you is not me, but it's the truth.
Isn't there a tshuva on heart transplants where he essentially says, I'm not writing my reasoning here because I don't want people to argue on it. I'm just telling you, you can't do them, something like that.
I don't remember. I seem to remember he writes his reasoning, but in his introduction, he says that, and he says for that reason, he says it has been the practice of great halachic authorities to never just do yes, no, mitzvah, avera. They always write out a lengthy treatise in which they're explaining at length their reasoning. I mean, you look at responsa, Noda Yehuda, the Chasson Sofer, the Tzitz Eliezer, the great responsa from contemporary, and they're lengthy answers. They lay out their reasoning because it's what obligates me. It's not just that he said it. Right, so it's type of interesting. That seems to indicate, in support Reb Chaim Voloshin's idea, that I have the right to. I can ask my rabbi, why do you say that? Is that, you know, does that, that doesn't, it that type of light rubs me wrong, right? And I think the rabbi has an obligation. No, I mean, it depends on time and place. Maybe he doesn't have time at that time, but at some point, right, to give an explanation. Why should I, right? Why should
I? Again, I just want
myself completely.
I just want you to say you agree or disagree with that thing about being autonomous and ultimately responsible for my own decisions.
I think you are commensurate with your knowledge, right? As I said, in other words,
but I'm trying my best.
So you're trying your best.
I'm not going to get off. If I was wrong, trying my best may not be enough.
Well, here's the point. Noda Yehuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau, one of the greatest writers of responsa, and he has a lengthy responsa which I should have actually gone through before this session, but in which he discusses what is the definition of when you are indemnified or not. So he seems to say if there was a mistake in the process, you're not indemnified. If the process was followed and there was no mistake in the process, but some other factor meant that things got messed up, I'm indemnified.
So let's say you're working with faulty factual information. The halachic treatment of the question was not flawed, but it was working with faulty data. So, and because of that, a person was told he could do something, and it ended up being, being wrong.
Was that a mistake in the process?
So I would say that's not. It's probably not
a mistake in the process,
right? Because he applied halachically. He applied everything, and he thought he's working with, the correct data. It ends up he's not working with the correct data.
Well, one example of that, I think might be a similar. This might be an analogy which Nodib Yehuda mentions, is the case of a man whose brother Loyaleno has died, without children. He's married. So we have an obligation of the surviving brother to marry the widow. Yibum. I think we discussed this last week, right?
Yeah.
Reincarnation. So so how long does he have to wait before he marries the widow? So halacha says he has to wait 3 months from the death of the brother before he marries the widow. Why is that? Because if she is pregnant from the dead brother, then not only is he not obligated to marry her, it's actually prohibited to marry her. It's considered a form of incest, right? So therefore, since the majority of women in the world, by 3 months, they are recognizably pregnant. Since he has now waited 3 months and he now marries her, he has done what halacha requires. Let's say he marries, he waits 3 months, 4 months in, she goes for a doctor's visit. Doctor says, mazel tov. She says, what are you talking about? Says, you're 4 months pregnant. 5 months pregnant, whatever.
Yeah.
So I think, if I remember correctly, in that case, he doesn't have to bring a sin offering.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Right? So that would be because the halacha right. The process was right. There's a factual.
Yeah.
It may be indemnified there. Right? Or the other exact. Yeah. Yeah. I think, Laura, an individual, Jews, you asked the Sanhedrin, it's a little complicated, but the Gemara and Horius, that's a lot of what the discussion revolves around, the first few duff. So I guess there's some type of spiritual indemnity. I just don't think, I think the trend in the religious world is a little different from this, but I think a person should not be giving up their brain and their independence and their thought, right? The rabbi said it. That's great. Let me ask him, am I not permitted to ask why that is so? Am I not permitted to ask, look, what rabbi, I have an extreme financial situation here, shalom, but whatever it is, did you take that into account, right? Now, we also know from the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law says, it's based on a Gemara and Avodah Zorah, Daf Yomi, in about 3 weeks or four. I don't know when it's going to get there. But a
few days.
2 weeks. No, but I mean the Gemara is later on.
Oh, right? I see.
Yeah. So let's say you asked a rabbi a question and he said prohibited. Are you allowed to ask another rabbi? So if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, it seems that as long as I tell the second rabbi that I asked the first rabbi, I say, listen, I asked Rabbi so-and-so, he said this. What do you think? Now it's on the other rabbi's head. If he thinks the first rabbi made a mistake, like he is just wrong, his mistake, then he's permitted to argue and tell me. And I'm not allowed to go to the second rabbi without telling him the first rabbi ruled. But if I tell him that the first rabbi did this ruling and he says, you know, he was, yeah, I mean, any rabbi is going to be reluctant to do that. That's like a very, quite serious. But if he felt the mistake was serious enough, he might say that, right? Is to'o b'dvar mishnah, whatever. He made a mistake in an explicit ruling. Right. So he can do that. And I, as the asker, have the right to do that. And to say, look, I asked him. His psak bothers me to no end. What do you say? Now the rabbi will say, listen, I'm not going to argue with him. He's a brilliant man, and as far as I'm concerned, it's over. Right?
Yeah.
Fine. Okay. Yeah. But if he says, well, tell me the situation. Tell me what he said. He has the right to, and I have the right to ask that. That's actually
so. Over. What if somebody, just being pragmatic, recognizes that, you know, someone is a tremendous Talmid Chacham and a tzaddik, and so just being pragmatic, he says, I'm gonna be better off, accepting his mistakes if he's gonna make a few mistakes, but I'm better off just being mavato myself to everything he says, to do everything he says in the long run. That'll be better for me than me thinking on my own.
Statistically, but you're
right. So I'm mavato, you know, as a strategy, I think in yeshiva, there were people around us who thought that this is supposed to be, that we're sort of being encouraged to have this strategy.
Definitely, definitely.
And I remember that Ramosha, you know, at the end of Mishkan HaTorah, so Ramosha, they weren't paying. And I remember I'm going to Ramosha and he goes, I don't understand it. They aren't paying you. Why aren't you going somewhere else and going? But we didn't want to leave, you know, like you didn't want to leave him and we didn't want to leave. And he's going, it's like you can't think for yourself. He said, we somehow taught you to be somebody who can't tie his shoes without asking us first. That's not good.
I remember distinctly at yeshiva, there was a guy who had, his hair was a little long and it was in the middle of Sphira. I don't know if he got a haircut before Pesach, but his hair was, one of the rabbis told him, he says, look, I'm telling you, it's permitted for you to get a haircut during the counting of the Omer. Walking around like this is a chilul Hashem. It's a desecration of God's name. So the guy went, that's what one of the yeshiva rabbis said. So he went to Rav Sheinberg.
Yeah.
And Rav Sheinberg looks at me and says, are you kidding me? With all the hippies around, it's fine. Number one. Second case.
Yeah.
Case number two. I remember I had a book that was a question. It was books in my dorm room.
That were not entirely Torah.
Yeah, things like the New Testament, History of Western Philosophy. There's some varied books that were not approved on the approved.
Prominent on your bookshelf. Could you turn around and reach the New Testament? Is it on the shelf right next to your...
I'd have to stand up.
It's not right next to your arm there? No, it's next to the menorah one?
It's next to the Quran.
Okay.
I'd have to stand up and get it. But
okay.
There. Anyway, so a guy told one of the rabbis, and the rabbi said, you're allowed to steal them and throw
destroy
them.
Destroy them.
So I went to Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, told him this, and he said...
It's Eliezer.
He said, this is gezel. This is theft. That's outright theft. Now, I remember just one incident, which was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I was running... for 1 year, a camp in Australia, an outreach program in Australia, in Sydney. Rabbi Revson asked me to assemble a team to go to Australia for that year. So I had a few people who are all phenomenal. And one of the guys in the kollel had a nephew or a cousin who was like 19, who today we would call an at-risk youth. I don't know what they called it then, but he was definitely at risk. And this this Kollel guy said, I think it would be great for my cousin to go as a counselor on this camp. It would just help him grow. And I said, you realize it's a mixed sleepaway camp for non-religious Australian teenagers. And he's going to be working with a number of women from Neve Yerushalayim. You think it's a good idea to send a 19-year-old guy who's at risk to something like this? He said, so he asked one of the rabbis. One of the rabbis said, absolutely, definitely you should take him. I said, I'm not taking him. I'm not taking him. It's too risky. So I got heat from the Kollel guys. How dare you, the Rosh Yeshiva? Rosh Yeshiva says you have to take him. What do you? So I said, look, okay, I'm taking this up the ladder. I went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Told Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach the situation. He looks at me and he says, who did Rabbi Revson hire to assemble the team? I said, me. He said, so it's your opinion he wants, not the Rosh Yeshiva's. I said, like, whoa. So that was type of interesting. It's almost contrary. I went to ask Das Torah about not following Das Torah. You know what I'm saying? I'm asking Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach what he says about, I type of self-contradictory to some degree. But I think that seems to at least be one of the, in the Litvish world, based on the Chazon Ish, based on Rav Chaim Volozhiner, the Igros Moshe, that seems to be the way we should be looking at it. I think popularly it's not looked at that way. Popularly, people will, I asked my Das Torah, which I just hate the grammar of that sentence, but okay.
Yeah.
You hear people saying, I asked my Das Torah. What do you mean you asked your Das? You have Das Torah? No, I asked so-and-so. What do you mean? Your Das? It's just like, okay, on so many levels that disturbs me. Grammar disturbs me. Anyway.
Ramosha, there was one time, I don't remember what prompted this, but I was talking to Ramosha and he said, I want you to do the following exercise. I want you to take this volume. We had this volume of it was like a 7-volume collection. It was like Das Musser or something like that. It was some kind of Musser collection. And one volume was devoted to Rabbi Yerucham. Mm-hmm. And so he said, I want you to take that volume. I want you to read one of the, essays from Rabbi Yerucham, mm-hmm. Mamorim. And then I want you to write your opinion about it to me. I want you to write out your opinion about it to me. So I said, my opinion about something that Rabbi Yerucham is writing? And he said, you have an opinion. You have an opinion. There's nothing wrong with having an opinion. If you state your opinion, if your opinion is wrong, you'll admit it. And but you're allowed to have an opinion. Not just that you're allowed to. He was telling me, I must. He was saying, you must. The truth is, you do have the opinion. You're just suppressing it when you're in this notion of being this notion that we're being mevatel ourselves to Das Torah. And it even comes to learning. Like people, there are people that are horrified if somebody actually thought about Pshat and Pasuk before they looked at Rashi.
Yeah.
David Foreman told me that he once was speaking at some summer camp, and it was a girls' summer camp, and the parents were there that day. So there were the girls and the parents. And afterwards, one of the parents came over to him and he said, that was absolutely beautiful. He said, but I walked in late. Who did you say that in the name of? Who actually said that? And so he said, I said it. And he goes, you just said that on your own? You're not saying that in the name of anybody? And the guy gets this horrified look on his face. And he said, I'm telling my daughter she could never listen to you. Like it was just like he had somehow crossed some line by actually learning the shot and thinking on his own about Torah. This is not saying you don't consult, you don't look at Rashi. You do look at Rashi, but how are you going to, Rashi had to learn it first in order to come to it, but there's people, that's how their learning is. Their learning is, who am I to have thoughts about this? I'm completely mavato myself, and I'm just going to receive. I'm just going to receive what they say. I'm going to receive their information, etc. In truth, you're not even getting their information because you don't even know why they're saying what they're saying because you didn't allow yourself to think. But there are very bright young scholars who think that that is their mandate, to absorb without thinking, because Rashi wrote everything with Ruach HaKodesh, and who are you to have a thought about something that was written by Ruach HaKodesh, which is what we're told about Rashi.
Yeah, I think it's very true. I think to a great degree, we have a lot of people have type of given up their autonomy and their independent thought. Now, I think there are many areas of life where I want to have the advice of someone who is wise, who is imbued with Torah. And I think it's much more valid, but it doesn't mean, but I'm willingly asking that person because I've thought about it. I cannot come to a clear decision on this, right? Yeah. What do I do?
Right.
So I can ask that's totally legitimate. And I think the Torah encourages that. Asei lecha rav, get yourself a rabbi, someone who is a little more objective than you about you, someone who is imbued with Torah. And I'm going to ask him questions which are not necessarily direct halachic questions. Right, that might be about where I'm living or a job. I mean, there are lots of areas of life where I think we need someone who has a special, you know, who's righteous and imbued with Torah, and I believe has some siyata d'shmaya. I think you know, we would ask Rav Moshe Shapiro questions. I think, you know, but it's type of interesting. A mutual friend of ours who has a yeshiva. Went to Rav Moshe to discuss whether he should throw out a certain guy from the yeshiva. And he gave his reasoning of why he should throw him out. Rav Moshe said to him, gave reasoning to not throw him out.
Yeah.
And the guy said, I remember he said to me, he says, Tov im ze ma sha'arav omer. If fine, if that's what the rabbi is saying, I'll. And Rav Moshe said to him, lo. He says, He says, I'm not a Hasidic Rebbe. I'm just presenting my perspective on it. Right? The decision is yours. It's your yeshiva. You know him. I'm just giving you a different perspective. I'm not telling you follow my opinion against your instinct, intuition, etc. No, not saying that. So that was type of interesting, right? But there were times that Rav Moshe would be very emphatic about something and say, this is, you know, but I felt that I could ask him.
I called him about if I had an issue with my mother-in-law. I called him about everything that was going on.
I did not
call. You didn't have any issues with my mother-in-law. That's why you didn't do it.
It probably is. Probably true. Yeah.
You never asked him.
I like Ajajib,
about something like that was going on in your life. You never asked him that kind of thing. Parenting advice.
Yes, did. Yeah, sure.
Spouse, spousal advice.
Parenting
advice. Yeah.
I think we have to at least acknowledge that on the one hand, right? In other words, it's a balance. On the one hand, seeking the advice of someone who is imbued with Torah and who is a righteous person and who's also et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, not totally giving up our autonomy and maintaining the ability to question and intellectually and even in a psak halacha, even, you know, there are people I can ask it's legitimate to ask a question. Someone gets upset at me for asking questions, I may have to find someone else.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, what I'm a human.
Yeah.
Right? And I have that right. Yeah. I think, yeah, you know, that's so. Okay, I don't know. We clarified a little bit about Das Torah.
We definitely talked about it.
We talked about it. I don't know if we clarified anything. I'm going to have to ask my dust.
I feel better, though. Yeah, ask your dust. That's a good idea.
So, okay. Yeah. Folks, if you enjoyed this, even if you didn't enjoy it a lot, but you found it interesting, like, share, tell your friends about it, all of them.
Yeah, and it would help Mordechai if you would watch it multiple times so it shows more views. He likes to see that.
That would help.
Everybody watched each episode 10 times, that would help.
Yes. Yeah. It would help my ego. Yeah. Yeah. It really would. Okay. All right.
All right.
It has been good to see you all, and thank you for watching. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.